Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a victory for People Power, with an apparent turnaround in Ukraine following an earlier about-face rejection of an agreement for closer ties with the EU. Anders Aslan, the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics, joins us to discuss Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych's latest U-turn and his family's ties to the oligarchy of tycoons who dominate an economy mired in corruption and cronyism. Then we will look into our own cronyism involved in the fire sale of valuable downtown properties belonging to the United States Postal Service that is being deliberately bankrupted by dictates from the U.S. Congress, whose free marketeers want to replace the USPS with postal kiosks in Walmarts. Dr. Gray Breschen, an historical geographer at UC Berkeley, joins us to discuss the exclusive contract that the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein has with a postmaster general determined to privatize the post office that bestows his company the right to sell off valuable and historic public properties across the country. Then finally, we will get an economic analysis of the consequences of ending unemployment benefits for the jobless on January the 28th. Cutting loose 1.3 million Americans into poverty, with another 1.9 million to come, as a result of the budget deal that Washington is celebrating as a bipartisan success. UCLA Professor of Economics Till von Wachter, who researches labor economics, the economy of aging, and the short and long-term effects of unemployment, joins us to discuss the lack of economic logic to Rand Paul and other conservatives' claim that they are helping people by cutting their benefits. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. His latest article at the BBC is Ukraine's Crisis, Yanukovych and the Tycoons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you.
And apparently there's been another U-turn in this, having had an about-face over rejecting the agreement for closer ties with the EU. It looks like the president of the Ukraine now is at least, I don't know whether he's making another U-turn, but according to the head of the EU, he's told her that he still wants to make the deal with Europe.
Well, I don't think that you should take it seriously. President Yanukovych is all the time saying all the good things, and then he does the opposite. In Vilnius, at the EU summit, his closest aide said hours before Yanukovych didn't sign anything that they were going to sign the full agreement. So Yanukovych simply has a habit of saying the opposite of what he actually does.
But there is underway a unprecedented, I think, demonstration of people power, is there not? He is surrounded. The opposition have occupied these main squares in Kiev. They have erected extremely sophisticated barriers. They seem to be very well organized. They seem to be determined. And all he's got is the riot police, right?
Indeed. I think that he has really painted himself into the corner. I totally agree with the spirit of your question, that it's amazing that he's not trying to compromise. But I presume that he realizes that he has gone too far, that he's in a dead end. And as you say, he has a few thousand riot police. The big businessmen have turned against him. And in the latest opinion poll before the protest, he had only 17% wanting to vote for him if there were presidential elections 1 month ago.
But in terms of your recent article at the BBC, Anders Aslan, Ukraine Crisis, Yanukovych and the Tycoons, what is underway then? Because the subtext in many ways for this second Orange Revolution, if that's the right way to describe it, is the widespread revulsion amongst most Ukrainians at their crony capitalism and corruption that is exemplified by Yanukovych's oldest son, Alexander, who is basically, I guess, is he getting kickbacks from the oligarchs? How does it work? Is it a trickle-down system of kickbacks, or is it rather like what you have in Russia under Putin, where he's the kind of capo di capo. He regulates the oligarchs. And a lot of reports indicate that he will retire, if he ever does, as one of the richest men on the planet.
Well, there's a big difference. Putin does exactly what you say. He operates as a godfather among the big businessmen. Yanukovych is not as wise as Putin. He wants to get it all himself. And his son then goes on to the big businessmen and says, for example, you and I are partners now. I own half of your enterprise, and you only own half of it. And that is very unpopular with the big businessmen. They are making money by buying enterprises cheaply in privatizations when there is only one buyer. They are forcing all kinds of businessmen, also the very big ones, to sell enterprises. They get the price, but the price that is being decided by the family and not by an open market. Half of the Western banks in Ukraine have already fled, and they are mostly sold out to representatives of the family, the Yanukovych family, and the other half of the West European banks are on the market because Yanukovych has seemingly intentionally made the business environment so awful that West European banks can no longer operate in Ukraine.
So this is the kind of looting that is one is sort of used to in the third world. So how different is it then in the second world, if indeed you can categorize the Ukraine as being a part of the second world?
Well, this is really very much like the third world. It's a family dynasty that Yanukovych has built up. So it's much more backward structurally than President Putin's role in Russia, where there are certain rules. You're not allowed to be political, but you can keep your fortune as long as you stay acceptable to President Putin. In Ukraine today, even the most powerful businessmen who have been close to President Yanukovych for years are now feeling that they have to give up enterprises to Yanukovych and his family.
Now, in terms of the title of your book, Anders Aslan, it doesn't seem to be ringing true with our conversation, right? You're talking about a market economy and a democracy, when in fact in our conversation so far you're talking about an oligarchy and a plutocracy.
This book was published in 2009 when Ukraine still was a democracy. And you can also see that Ukraine is a much freer society than Russia, that the opposition has about 40% of the seats in the parliament. The protests are now being broadcast by three parallel television channels all the time. The oligarchs are now covering with the big television channels the protests quite objectively. And Ukraine has abolished visas for Western people, so one can travel very freely there. So Ukraine is a much freer and a more open society than Russia is still. But the economic mismanagement, as I discussed, has been quite awful for the last couple of years under President Yanukovych.
So is there any justification to Putin's objections that if the Ukraine joins the EU, they will therefore flood Russia with EU products?
No, there's none whatsoever. If you have a free trade agreement, then you have something called rules of origin, that is only products from your country that can enter the other country without tariffs. So President Putin and his aides clearly don't know much about trade policy, nor do I think that they care about it.
Well, what they do know about, though, is blackmail and naked thuggery, if you will. They're willing to turn off the tap. They've turned off the gas pipeline that goes through the Ukraine to Europe, which is one of their main sources of revenue. So they can play hardball.
Oh, sure. But I would rather emphasize that Russia tends to shoot itself in the foot all the time. It tries now to push countries into a customs union, which is highly protectionist. If Ukraine would join it, its GDP would fall further, and it would get all kinds of conflict with other countries. The Russian market is anyhow totally unreliable, so it's not that you benefit anything. Ukraine has sharply reduced its imports of gas from Russia because it's so unreliable, and Russian gas from the state-controlled gas giant is losing out very seriously on all markets because it misbehaves so much. So I think that this cost President Putin a lot and his country, and it doesn't make much sense. He would be much better advised to try to be more peaceful and try to develop his economy. Instead, we are seeing that the Russian economic growth is coming close to zero now.
And what he's offering the Ukraine in this customs union, of course, is joining countries such as Belarus and Kazakhstan, which are hardly thriving economies, with free and open democratic expression. They're, at least in the case of Belarus, it's almost an anachronism. It isn't, goes back to the Cold War.
Indeed, and also the Russian arguments are that Ukrainian produce is so bad that it can't compete in Europe, and therefore it should try to sell on the Russian and Kazakh markets where much worse products are accepted. It's hardly an attractive appeal.
So how do you separate out then, Anders Aslan, the economics from the politics? Because it does seem that Putin is an entirely political animal. You know, we're making the assumption now that he's in many ways trying to pull the strings here, if he's not in fact doing that. He's obviously incapable of advancing Russia, but he seems to be obsessed with trying to diminish America. And this paranoia about NATO moving east, I thought that was pretty much settled. We're not talking about Georgia and Ukraine joining NATO, as John Bolton is arguing in a piece in the Los Angeles Times. We're talking about an economic integration into Europe. Does it have any military and political aspects to it, this EU deal?
Not really. There is an EU security policy, but nobody would take it seriously. So this is really just a negative attitude, and if Russia would be rational, Russia would try to get a free trade agreement with Europe exactly as Ukraine. Now Russia is preoccupied by harming other countries, and if you look up on it, Moldova and Georgia, they did sign deep and comprehensive free trade agreements now with the European Union, and they are not suffering any Russian repercussions. So instead, it's Ukraine that hesitated and didn't sign that is suffering from the Russian trouble. And this is what President Putin is offering, all sticks and no carrots, and you don't attract people in that way.
But is Putin and, to some extent, Yanukovych acting out of the fact that they don't want any kind of transparency? If you have this rampant crony capitalism and this one family in the Ukraine is basically stealing the country blind to the point where even the oligarchs are in revolt against them, are there any measures in this EU agreement that would enforce the kind of transparency that would expose Yanukovych and his family to even more sunlight and, by extension, Putin?
Indeed, this is the critical factor. So there were two conditions that Yanukovych was not prepared to fulfill of the EU conditions for the association agreement. One was to let Yulia Tymoshenko, the run-up presidential candidate in the last elections that Yanukovych defeated with a tiny margin, to keep her, to let her out of prison, where Yanukovych has put her for 7 years for purely political reasons. And the other condition that it didn't fulfill, it was to adopt a law on prosecution, because Ukraine still have an old Soviet system of prosecution, where the prosecutor, believe it or not, is superior to the judge. So the prosecutor can change a court verdict to the benefit of political repression if he so desires. So these were the two conditions Yanukovych refused to sign. So my sense is that Yanukovych, all what he said that he would sign, had decided long ago, I'm never going to sign this because it will diminish my possibility of arbitrary rule in this country. At the same time, he wanted to say that he was going to sign because otherwise the big businessmen would revolt against him. The big businessmen are not afraid of European competition. They are afraid of Yanukovych and his family stealing, in the literal sense, the enterprises from them.
But isn't one of the reasons why Yanukovych came back in this last election, where apparently it was free and fair, is because of the divisions and the almost ridiculous infighting in the amongst what is now the opposition, but was originally the Orange Revolution that swept the reformers into power? I mean, Yanukovych is actually poised to go down in history as the only man to be kicked out twice by people power, right?
Well, it's an interesting observation. Of course, the Orange government was quite bad, but and it was in a steady stalemate. But a major reason for this was that President Viktor Yushchenko, the winner in after the Orange Revolution, went over to Yanukovych's side and worked in the elections in 2010 and the parliamentary elections 2012 as a provocateur for Yanukovych. That is, he pushed a hard nationalist line in order to take Yulia Tymoshenko further to the nationalist side than she wanted to go, and also to deter people in the East so that they would vote more for Yanukovych. And the proof of it is that former President Yushchenko, who was perceived as the main enemy of Viktor Yanukovych, still lives in the presidential residence outside of Kiev at a public cost of $3 million a year. So the relationship between Yanukovych and Yushchenko is that good. Yushchenko is simply paid by Yanukovych. And we don't know when this started. But sometimes during President Yushchenko's tenure, during the last 2 years, he vetoed virtually every decision that Prime Minister Tymoshenko took. And since Yushchenko was the main hero of the Orange Revolution, people do not want to say this in public, but this is the truth.
Well, this is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? It's almost Shakespearean, the idea that a guy who was poisoned by Yushchenko and the dark forces there ends up being bought by him and living under his roof.
Quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah, so nobody wants to talk about Yushchenko now. He's just disappeared from the public eye. Well, he has actually popped up a little bit in the last few days, but apart from that, he has been gone.
Well, Anders Aslan, we have to leave you now, but I guess we can at least be a little optimistic that so far people power is winning, right?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful, but it's also involving great risk. So Yanukovych clearly wants to try to clamp out and tire out the opposition. And if they lose, then they will end up in large numbers in prison, so they had better not lose out, and the way of doing so is on the one hand to be peaceful, on the other hand to be out in hundreds of thousands so that Yanukovych's thousands of riot police can't change the situation.
Well, I thank you again for joining us, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. And his latest article at the BBC is Ukraine Crisis, Yukanovich and the Tycoons. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the cronyism involving Senator Feinstein's husband and the Postmaster General, a free marketeer, who is giving away historical public properties at fire sale prices.
What a crime! In the old time, it was not a crime! Not a crime! Right there, that's the postman asleep in the sand. He's got a kit well called to deliver. He's gonna do it by hand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Gray Breschen, who is an historical geographer and author. He is currently a visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. His books include Farewell Promised Land, Waking Up from the California Dream, and Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Gray Breschen.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And it seems that we've spoken in the past, over the last few years, about how the post office is being subject to a fire sale thanks to congressional pressure, and that these valuable and historic pieces of real estate are being offered up as for fire sale prices by an insider deal that's been struck with the husband of California Senator Dianne Feinstein. So let's get into the nitty-gritty in terms of that particular relationship. Tell us about Feinstein's husband, why it is that he gets to decide who gets these prime real estate properties.
Well, we'd actually like to know that. It's very difficult to find out. But as to him, Richard Blum is a billionaire private equity investor. He has an enormous empire, which has many different parts to it, and it's changing all the time, so it's difficult to follow it. But his real estate tentacle is a company called CBRE, C.B. Richard Ellis, which is the largest commercial real estate company in the world. It's actually international. And about 2 years ago, CBRE got an exclusive contract with the U.S. Postal Service to sell the public's property, which includes all of these historic post offices with New Deal art in them. But it also includes mail processing facilities. It's an incredible gold mine because it includes extremely valuable downtown property in every city and town in the country. And this is all being peddled by CBRE now. The Venice Post Office was recently sold by CBRE. And so when I heard this, I thought, well, this kind of stinks. He is the husband of one of the most powerful U.S. senators. And although her staff swears that they never discuss business and there's an absolute firewall between her public service and his private profit-making, that stretches belief a bit. Because, of course, California has community property laws, so they share everything. Whatever he makes, she takes, too. None of the press would follow out this, although it has a certain stench about it. I couldn't get anybody to follow up on it, but an independent investigative reporter, Peter Byrne, actually spent about a year prying the information out of the U.S. Postal Service by using Freedom of Information Act and other means. And what he found was that CBRE not only is representing the seller, that is the U.S. Postal Service, but it should be us, the public, but it's also representing the buyers as well, too. And it's advising the Postal Service on which properties to sell. This is an extraordinarily favorable contract with the Postal Service. The Postal Service will not divulge how that contract was negotiated. It claimed to Peter Byrne that, in fact, it was something like national security, and so it didn't have to give up the details of this contract. So you've got a direct conflict of interest in representing both the seller and the buyer, but it's not lucrative for the U.S. Postal Service, but it's very lucrative for CBRE. And what Byrne found is that in many of the cases, most of the cases he looked at, they were selling these properties at well below market value to their associates and sometimes even to themselves. So that's what happens when you get hold of a real estate portfolio built up by the U.S. public, by the taxpayer over a century, that's now estimated to be worth something like $100 billion. And CBRE essentially has gotten the control of that real estate portfolio, which really should belong to all of us.
So also, obviously, this author has done a great job, Peter Byrne. He has a new book out called Going Postal. The husband of U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein has been selling post offices to his friends cheap. But also, Ralph Nader has joined in. He has written letters to the Postmaster General Donahue, and he's also written letters to Senator Feinstein asking her to introduce legislation to put a halt to this fire sale of U.S. Postal Service buildings around the country. Have you heard anything in terms of what Ralph Nader has heard back from Dianne Feinstein?
The last I heard, he's heard nothing from Dianne Feinstein. She has not responded to his open letter, which was pretty searing, actually. And I haven't read the one that he's written to Donahoe yet, but Donahoe certainly deserved a letter because, as you may know, Ben Franklin was the first Postmaster General, and at the rate that Donahoe is going, he will be the last because he's essentially liquidating a public service that's mandated in the U.S. Constitution. And once again, the press simply has not been following this. It's not been following the liquidation of our postal service or the cultural resources that we're losing as it goes out of business, as he puts it out of business, and as the Postal Service moves, and this just happened, actually, it now has a contract with Staples. So it's moving from architecturally distinguished and artistically embellished buildings, which the public owns, into outlets in Staples stores, which will be staffed by non-union people, not postal employees, but non-union low-wage people. And we're trying to find out how they're going to ensure the safety and security of mail, because the Postal Service has, again, spent about a century building up an exemplary system of mail security. We have some of the safest mail in the world. And, of course, it's the last means of private communication, or relatively private communication, that we have, which brings me back to Senator Feinstein, who, of course, has been one of the foremost cheerleaders for almost unlimited NSA spying on U.S. citizens and other people around the world. As head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she's been incredibly enthusiastic about these violations of our Fourth Amendment, which Edward Snowden has revealed to us.
But what's causing the post office's financial problems? And after all, that's all the press ever say, that the financially troubled post office, they they buy in, or they bought into the canard that the Postal Service is going broke because of UPS and FedEx and that they're relics. What they never talk about is the reason that the Postal Service is going broke is that the Congress mandated a uniquely punitive way of forcing the Postal Service to pre-fund its pension plans to the point now where the U.S. government owes the USPS between $50 and $75 billion. Nobody else in government has been asked to pre-fund something like 75 years' worth of pensions into the future. This is for an organization that is having to cut its staff every day and sell off its facilities. So it doesn't make any sense. And you have to go back to what happened, I think it was around 2007 under the Bush administration, that this unique punitive bill was passed. And that seems to have been one of those deliberate efforts on the part of the Republicans who basically their philosophy of government is that the U.S. government should be a piggy bank for their rich friends.
Well, what you're talking about is the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, which is one of those euphemisms that's almost laughable if it wasn't so tragic. It was passed around midnight by a lame duck Congress and signed into law by George W. Bush. It appears to have been written by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which, of course, is a tentacle of the Koch brothers. It's an ingenious act, of course, because, as you say, it requires the Postal Service to prepay retiree health care 75 years into the future and do it within 10 years. And that's causing most of the red ink that we're seeing from the Postal Service. It was brilliantly designed, which is why it's almost certainly from ALEC. And so it's bankrupting the Postal Service and forcing it to liquidate. It's actually, behind all of this are a series of white papers by right-wing and libertarian think tanks like Cato and American Enterprise and others. They've been advocating for years the privatization of the U.S. Postal Service, and it was actually a platform in the GOP, it was a plank in the GOP platform in the last election, the privatization of our public service. So it's all going according to plan. It's just the media hasn't been covering it. And one other thing, in that legislation, the Postal Accountability Act, is also a clause that says that the Postal Service cannot compete with the private sector. So there are ways that, of course, it could use its monopoly powers to very handily compete with UPS and FedEx, for example, by delivering alcohol, wine, and other liquors, as well as by opening a postal savings bank in all of its post offices, which would then serve the 50 million or so unbanked Americans. We once had that. We had it up until, I think it was 1966, and then the retail banking industry got rid of it. So if Postmaster General Donahoe really wanted to save the U.S. Postal Service, which he clearly doesn't, what you would do is to increase services to the American public rather than decreasing them, which is what he's doing right now. And that's setting the Postal Service into this death spiral that we're seeing, where it seems that the only thing that you can do is to essentially sell off its assets. By the way, the United Kingdom, under the Cameron administration, has already done that. They just sold the Royal Mail. Ours is 238 years old. The British system was 500 years old, but they just sold that, which is something that even Margaret Thatcher wouldn't do.
So Dr. Gray Breschen, I have spoken in the past to Senator Bernie Sanders about this issue of the post offices, and he seems to be one of the only people in the Congress that's trying to fight to stop this deliberate dismembering of this venerated institution that really serves rural Americans in a unique way. In the post offices, in many ways, in small towns, is where everybody meets when they collect their mail. And he pointed out that, as you just said, that it wasn't that long ago in the 1960s that you had these post office banks. And Bernie listed a whole bunch of other ways that they could make money, selling fishing licenses, hunting licenses, all of those things that rural America depends upon. And it's worth noting that the post office banks in Japan are the biggest source of savings in the entire country. And, you know, the Japanese have huge savings compared to the United States. So we are desperately in need of a public banking system at any rate to compete with Wall Street, which is, you know, putting various municipalities are going under because they've had to deal with Wall Street. And but for the state of North Dakota, nobody else in this country has a public bank or a state bank which is designed to fund infrastructure, which every other country in the world does, at least in the advanced world. So this is it seems to me that you could kill two birds with one stone here. You could revive public banking and save the post office.
Well, if you wanted to do it, but obviously,
of course, I'm tilting at windmills here.
Don't want to,
I know,
because otherwise they would be doing it as well as Congress, I should say.
Right. Well, I know it's one of those wouldn't it be nice kind of conversations which are kind of futile, but it, you know, I'm trying to point out here the obscenity of our Congress and this disgusting relationship between elected officials and private individuals, some of whom happen to be spouses.
Yes, and again, I have to come back to the dereliction of the press because it simply hasn't been covering this. When I've given my presentation about what Americans are losing and what they own, people in the audience actually are brought to tears because they didn't know this is happening. And to its credit, your own local newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, just did a superb article in the Sunday edition. I believe it was on the front page, and it's one of the best articles I've read so far. And it's the first significant mention in the mainstream press of the Feinstein-Blum connection to the sell-off of our property. Nobody else, including Frontline, 60 Minutes, Bill Moyers, nobody has been willing to take this on because of Feinstein's enormous power. But the LA Times did take it on, and I really tip my hat to them.
So, Greg Reshin, tell us about your post office there in Berkeley, a 1914 second Renaissance revival style main post office, which is decorated with New Deal art.
Yes, Berkeley has a, as you say, a Renaissance-style post office. It's modeled after Brunelleschi's Foundling Hospital in Florence. It's one of the handsomest post offices in California, if not the country. And it's part of our civic center. We were proud of it, but we took it for granted that it would be ours forever. And last year, the Postal Service announced it was going to sell our main post office. And nothing that we did, none of the community meetings that we had or the unanimous opposition of the mayor and the city council or our elected representatives, none of this mattered at all. It hasn't anywhere else in California or the country. They take testimony and then they say, we're going to sell it because we have a financial crisis. But it's not the Postal Service, of course, that's selling it. It's CBRE, this real estate company controlled by Feinstein's husband. And so we've watched over the last few months as, despite all of our opposition, our protests, the encampment in front of the post office, which went on for over a month, what we've watched is they have just drained it of staff, processing facilities, now the retail desk. They're getting ready to move to a Staples outlet down the street where think of the difference of what you feel when you go into one of those old post offices like the one in Santa Monica or Venice or La Jolla, all of which are up for sale or have been sold. The difference between that and when you go into the back of a Staples store and you're dealt with by a low-paid, non-union person who may not really be adequately trained. It's a very, very different experience, especially if the post office has unique art in it that it was designed for that site, which Berkeley does. We have a mural that represents Berkeley's history, and we also have a sculptural plaque that represents the heroism of mail processing, of something we take for granted, but which in its is not only just very useful, but at times it can be extremely dangerous. A postal carrier was just murdered in the East because the letter carriers are now having to work well after dark, and he was shot down And this is because of the understaffing that's going on at this point. So we continue the fight in Berkeley to save our post office and our public service. There is an organization called the National Post Office Collaborate, which is based in Berkeley. I'm a member of it. And we're raising the legal fees to fight the U.S. Postal Service. And we've actually won in Stamford, Connecticut. We've gotten a temporary restraining order against the Postal Service to stop the selling of a similarly handsome historic post office in downtown Stamford, which CBRE also wants to sell. So we're continuing the fight. Berkeley is the epicenter of resistance in the country. We're showing the way for other communities that you can take on the Postal Service, even if it is run like the Kremlin these days.
And, of course, the Postal Service under Postmaster General Patrick Donahue are planning to set up postal kiosks in Walmarts. So there you have it, Gray. And I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Gray Breschen, who is an historical geographer and author. He is currently a visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. His books include Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream, and Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll get an economic analysis of the consequences of cutting loose 1.3 million Americans into poverty. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Till von Wachter, who is an associate professor of economics at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a faculty research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. His fields of interest include labor economics, the economics of aging, and the effects of short and long-term unemployment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Till von Wachter.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, of course, the deal that was done between Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray is being hailed on Capitol Hill as a model of bipartisanship, but it faces, I think, an uphill battle in Congress because already on the right, Republicans are screaming at Paul Ryan for selling out, and on the left, a lot of Democrats are very upset that long-term unemployment benefits are being cut. Let's start with that. What's your understanding then of whether these benefits could be resurrected?
Well, it's hard to predict how the political outcome is going to be. Of course, it would be a great benefit to the unemployed job seekers who are going to be cut off from unemployment insurance benefits. And as far as I can tell, at least from the benefit side, there are several findings pointing to the fact that this will actually be beneficial for workers at not very much cost to society.
Well, needless to say, the benefits are cut off on December the 28th, a little after Christmas, and not exactly a pleasant prospect for the 1.3 million Americans who are going to be cut off the rolls. But in terms of an economy, one of the arguments that were made about cutting off food stamps, or one of the arguments against cutting off food stamps, which recently happened, was that food stamps are an immediate boost to the economy because the money is immediately spent and it has a multiplying effect. Wouldn't that also apply to economic benefits from unemployment insurance money?
Certainly. Insofar as there is a multiplier effect that will be affected by a potential cutback in consumption of the people who are cut off from unemployment insurance benefits. And what we do know that individuals who are cut off from unemployment insurance benefits do reduce their consumption. And this is particularly so for households who have little other means of financing their expenditures. And these are often single-earner households with children. Now, so there is a substantial group of workers who is likely to suffer from the income loss and will see a decline in expenditure, and that will disproportionately fall on single-earner household and children. So that's an important concern. However, in terms of the magnitude of the multiplier effect, that's actually much harder to pin down. So there are some studies that suggest that there is a multiplier effect. But how large it is and how large the effect from a UI extension would be is a bit harder to tell.
But I think a lot of economists agree that it doesn't make any sense to slow the economy down with these cuts when we're still in a recovery. That seems to be, except for a few economists on the right, that seems to be a fairly well-established fact.
I'm going to rephrase that a little bit. So generally, if we talk about unemployment insurance extensions, one thinks of potential costs and potential benefits. And the potential costs are often viewed or often interpreted as workers reducing their willingness to take jobs and hence a prolonging of unemployment spells. And then that might also lead to a reduced willingness of firms to create jobs because there are fewer people willing to take those jobs. Right? So this negative effect on employment and job creation is now thought to be rather small, especially when the labor market is still depressed. So the cost of extending these unemployment insurance benefits for these very long-term unemployed in terms of reduced employment is likely to be rather low. And on the other hand, as I said earlier, the benefits for these individuals of extending UI payments are relatively large. And especially so because the people who disproportionately suffer or might suffer from these are children, because there's some evidence that there might be long-term effects from parental job loss and parental unemployment on kids. However, right, just from a pure multiplier point of view, that is a harder to establish fact.
What we're talking about here in terms of what's being cut in terms of unemployment insurance is $26 billion. And Senator Rand Paul, appearing on Fox News on Sunday, said that when you allow people to be on unemployment insurance for 99 weeks, you're causing them to become part of this perpetual unemployment group in our economy. Now, it turns out that he got the number wrong. The maximum is actually 73 weeks. But I don't understand that idea that you supposedly allowing people to be on unemployment insurance is somehow hurting them, and therefore you have to cut off their benefits in order to help them. Where in God's name is the logic in that?
That's a fair question. In all fairness to that argument, so there is a long and established literature in economics that empirically estimates what happens to individuals' job search activities if you prolong unemployment insurance. And now one does see that if you extend unemployment insurance benefits, individuals tend to stay longer in unemployment. So at prima facie, there's some evidence for the argument that extending unemployment insurance, right, would lead to longer unemployment spells. However, an important point to note is that this effect is usually small when there are actually no jobs to be found. Given that the labor market is still quite weak, right, we wouldn't expect this to be a particular problem in the current environment, although there might be some effect. A second point to note is that what people have in mind when they make this argument that unemployment insurance extension will lead to lower job finding rate is that individuals are sitting at home comparing their benefits at unemployment with the potential gain from getting a job. And certainly that relative gain is reduced if you get higher or longer payments. However, that's not the only thing that happens. It is actually that people would just take a job because they don't have any money, right? And because they have expenditures that they have to pay. You have to pay their bills, the rent, and so on. So by giving unemployment insurance, you're not changing the calculation of whether people want to work or not relative to sort of the benefit from working. You're just allowing them to spend more time looking for that better job. So in sort of economic speak, there is sort of not as much of a substitution effect where people substitute working for staying at home. Rather, there's an income effect. People need the additional money to pay the bill. So in other words, what people often think of a distortion in behavior, right, is not really a distortion. It was that people did not have enough money to finance their expenditures and simply use that UI extension to, you know, spend a little bit more time searching for a better job.
But
in other words, yes, there's some evidence that unemployment insurance lengthens unemployment durations, and that's been used as an argument against extending unemployment insurance. But if you look more closely, right, this is unlikely to be such a big problem in a depressed labor market as we're in now.
Well, I think that was the question I had earlier, Till von Wachter, is in terms of a depressed labor market, and we're still in a recovery from the 2008 crash, and the statistics are pretty encouraging in terms of the long-term jobless. They have declined from nearly 7 million in 2010 to 4.1 million in November of 2013. So we're already heading in the right direction because we are in recovery. So that was my argument earlier, or at least my question earlier, is that in a recovering economy, it doesn't seem to make any sense to make any cuts that would translate into a modifying effect in terms of consumption. And the evidence that the long-term jobless rates are going down because we're recovering reinforces what I'm saying, surely.
Well, certainly, you know, from just the point of view of creating more expenditures, it wouldn't hurt to make sure that unemployed, long-term unemployed, aren't spending less. You're absolutely right. All I was saying earlier is that, you know, relative to the entire economy, right, it's not clear how large that shock coming from a boost in product demand will be, right? And in fact, that's been pretty elusive empirically to find out how large these effects are going to be. But you're absolutely right in thinking that, well, it's unlikely to hurt to increase product demand, at least in the short run. However, well, you know, the counter-argument that there are costs because individuals' labor supply choices are distorted in a way by UI, right? These counter-arguments have received empirical support, and it's just very important to look at the nuances of these findings, namely that the distortionary effect of unemployment insurance is smaller in depressed labor markets as we are in now.
But we're talking about a total cost of $26 billion. And if from 2010 the jobless market has declined from 7 million in 2010 to 4.1 million in November, while these unemployment benefits existed, I'm trying to make the suggestion that isn't that evidence that it's working, that unemployment insurance works in terms of reducing joblessness? Or am I off the wall here?
Well, there's many things happening at the aggregate level during that period.
Of course.
So you're right that this has been an argument in favor of programs increasing expenditure, which includes unemployment insurance. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is Congress' sort of research arm, has, you know, generated studies giving sort of the best of what we know of how to sort of gauge these effects, and there are likely to be some effects. As sort of from my position as a researcher, I can tell you that it's much harder to pin down what the magnitudes of these effects are. Whereas it's pretty clear that there is a benefit for the people who are running out. Many of these people who are running out of benefits would, in absence of an extension, or will, in an absence of an extension, likely to be transiting into poverty, and that affects particularly single earner households with children. So there is a good case to extend UI benefits even in the absence of such a multiplier effect, because the benefits for the affected individuals are high, and the likely cost in terms of further extending unemployment spells are likely to be low.
Well, this cut starting on December the 28th, where 1.3 million jobless people will be cut off and will receive no unemployment benefits, there is another 1.9 million who are about to be cut in the first half of 2014. So the process is compounding, and I'm just curious to know, I know it's a political question, but I'm just curious to know what kind of arguments are going to be made now in the House, both on the Republican side to defend the idea that people simply will be thrown into poverty for what is chump change in the overall scheme of things when you look at the entire federal budget. And on the other side, I'm curious to know how the Democrats are going to make their arguments, which clearly Patty Murray, as their representative, failed to make or failed to win.
Well, from a purely political point of view, and that is not my field, but it seems to be that there is a price tag to extending unemployment insurance benefits, and it is just difficult or costly to find other ways to offset that increase in benefits. From the point of view of the people affected, right, they would, very much like to, or it's likely that they would be better off having slightly higher taxes in the future and receiving the unemployment insurance benefits now, if you understand what I mean, in the sense that the best of the research we have at the moment in labor economics suggests that for these individuals, looking forward, the benefits from receiving UI benefits now outweigh the costs in terms of higher tax expenditures for them in the future. Right? The problem is, politically, this money has to come from other individuals now. That it cannot be simply sort of taken from the individual as they're getting reemployed in the future. And that's sort of what seems to create the political problem. So even though, from what we can tell, these benefit extensions would be beneficial to the individuals, even if you made them completely pay for it through higher taxes on their own labor earnings in the future, right? It's hard to institute that politically because currently the money has to come from another program.
But a part of this deal, of course, is to increase taxes on new government new hires in government employment. So why discriminate against government employees? I guess you can't mandate that for the private labor market. Is that the problem?
That's a good question. And
pension contributions. Pensions for public employees are quite generous compared to what is currently available in the private sector. And so what may have happened is there's a realignment there.
Right, but it's a realignment. It's a realignment in terms of a race to the bottom, isn't it?
That would be actually an interesting question for a completely separate show, in the sense that there is a complicated set of patterns by which companies may have overpromised benefits when things were doing well, in the sense that they may have just used the promise of future payments to get an easy way out of complicated, labor relations, and at some point that it's going to become clear that this was not financially viable, and the same thing may have happened for sort of the public sector. But that sort of requires a discussion reaching way back to the beginning of when these pension plans were instituted.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Till von Wachter.
Thank you for an interesting discussion.
Again, I've been speaking with Till von Wachter, who is an associate professor of economics at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a faculty research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. His fields of interest include labor economics and the economics of aging and the effects of short and long-term unemployment. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.